Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in African American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Omari Averett Phillips, the host of the channel, and today we'll be talking to Dr. Mario Nesbitt about his new book, The Workings of Diaspora, Jamaican Maroons and the Claims to Sovereignty. Dr. Mario Nesbitt, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
So, Dr. Nesbitt, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us just a bit about yourself.
Okay, as you said, my name is Dr. Mario Nesbitt. I'm currently a visiting assistant teaching professor at Syracuse University in the Department of African American Studies for 2022-2013 year. But my home institution is actually in Cape Coast, Ghana, and I'm lecturer there in the Center for African and International Studies and at the University of Cape Coast. So that's, that's a little bit about myself. My background is actually in African diaspora studies, and I also teach classes related to that area. Currently at Syracuse, I'm teaching Caribbean since independence and a course on Pan-Africanism.
Awesome. Wonderful. Well, let's talk a little bit about this book, right? So how did you come to this project?
Okay, so the project was a project from actually graduate school. So I have my PhD from the University of California, Berkeley, and I was in the Department of African American Studies. So originally started at a dissertation project in grad school, and originally I wanted to look at Maroon communities. I was interested in Maroon communities and I was interested in how does a small group survive, are able to create a society, a community under colonial, colonization throughout the Americas. So I wanted to explore that. But I also wanted to explore what is diaspora and what work does diaspora, what work does it do, and so I wanted to explore that a bit. And in the work itself, I look at diaspora, the framing of diaspora, how diaspora is used by other scholars like Joseph Harris, Colin Palmer, and Stuart Hall. And I wanted to get a definition of diaspora, but also to how does diaspora work? Like, how does it work? And what work does it do? So that was really the beginning of really working on the research project, like trying to merge those two ideas, really.
And I wonder if we could just talk a little bit about this idea of diaspora that you have here. Could you explain how your work sort of seeks to expand our understanding of diasporas through it?
Yes, so my work seeks to expand on diaspora in the sense of like what other scholars have done. Many scholars have looked at what diaspora is and how it works and how it's practiced. I wanted to look at... So when I was trying to find out what diaspora is, there were three things that keep coming up in terms of exploring diaspora. That's the issue of the first issue that is in the work itself is looking at Black objection, which is, in other words, looking at the attempts to dehumanize people of African descent, Africans and people of African descent. So this idea keep coming up, I think, in all the definition of diaspora, this idea of the displacement of the African. And then the other idea that is also associated with diaspora is often roots, like the origins, African origins, in terms of when we talk about the African diaspora in particular, and then the issue of some sort of solidarity or conscious collective consciousness. So in my work, what I was trying to do is to see these three elements, how they are used in communities of African descent, how they practice this idea of diaspora, critically practice this idea of diaspora. And the work tried to argue that when we have a community that identifies with that diaspora, they usually engage those three elements. And when they engage those elements, each community, I argue, engage those elements in different ways. So, for example, the Maroons have a particular narrative of their origins, which is in the African continent, but they focus on coming from Ghana. But if you look at another group of people of African descent, say, for example, Rastafari, you know, they would trace their origins to Africa, of course, but they would highlight perhaps Ethiopia in terms of their connection. So the work tried to expand and look at diaspora, like how does it work critically in a particular community of African descent, and what is it, why is it used, or why is it needed, and what is the goal of diaspora itself and in particular communities.
Wonderful. And we'll talk more about those three elements that you just brought up in just a minute. But I wonder if you could also just explain to listeners who might not know what a Maroon Society is, and just sort of give us an overview of those, of the Maroon Societies that you actually focus on in this work.
Okay, yeah. So in the work to myself, I explore what are Maroon communities, and I try to look at the definitions, different definitions used to define Maroon communities, look at the origins of the concept. And most people know the origins of the concept come from Simaroons, and it was associated with enslaved Africans leaving the plantation, indigenous people leaving the plantation. And so I try to look at the different definitions and scholars' definition, but I also try to look at Maroons themselves. How do they define diaspora themselves? And so I would propose the definition of diaspora, link it closely to the Maroons, is that it's a group of people who liberated themselves from enslavement or slavery to create, deliberate themselves from slavery and enslavement to create autonomous communities that tried to secede from the slave plantation that they were enslaved on, and they seek freedom, you know, for men, women, and children. So that's how I basically look at Maroon communities. And in different parts of the Americas, Maroon communities exist, like in many of the Spanish-speaking territories, they would be called Palenques. In Brazil, they would be called Quilombos. And in different places, they would be called different names, but those communities strive for different things. And what was interesting to me in the research was also, too, that they had Maroon communities all over the Americas. There were thousands of them. And they existed in a way that made it difficult for Europeans to claim complete territorial control over spaces that they claimed that they had control over. I mean, the indigenous people did the same thing too, but Maroon communities were the communities that tried to resist and separate themselves from slavery. So in particular, the Jamaican Maroons, which I looked at most closely, I look at the Jamaican Maroons. I also look at the Jamaican Maroon story about their origins and what other scholars say about Maroons' origins and what is in the archives in terms of the Jamaican origins. And so within the literature, it's complicated, but the earlier literature in Maroon communities, you know, often focus on the archives, you know, archival documents and the documents written by usually people who are enemies of the Maroons. So, you know, so for the Jamaican Maroons, their narrative, and I will privilege their narrative and maybe look at how it compares to other interpretation of their origins. But the Maroons see themselves as liberated Africans. And some Maroons would argue that they have indigenous origins, depending on the group of Maroons you speak to, depending which member of the community you speak to. Some would stress, would mention indigenous origins, or others would say it's only African origins. So I present that in the work, but Maroons would all trace their origins going back to the old early period of Spanish colonization, where Africans left the plantation during the Spanish colonization and created communities. And then when the British came to displace the Spanish, some Africans also gained their freedom during that time period and joined the Maroons in the hill or created their own communities. And from the Maroons' perspective, they fought the British for 80 years. And it was around 1739, where after 80 years of fighting the British, they signed a treaty with the British government. And at this point, five communities emerged basically in Jamaica around that time period, because the community were in, they moved, but most of the Maroons, they trace the clear origins of the community at this time period of the signing of the treaty, which was in the late 1730s. And there were about five communities, and they included the Windward Maroons, which is referred to as the Windward Maroons, and the Leeward Maroons. And the Leeward Maroons were located more on the western end of Jamaica, while the Windward Maroons were on the eastern end of Jamaica. And so the Leeward Maroons were made up of mainly two communities, a community called Kojotang, Cholanitang, and the other community was Akampangtang. And then on the other end, with the Windward Maroons, they had different communities where eventually the three communities that emerged was Moatang, which was New Nanitang, and then we have Scots Hall, and then we have Charleston. Crawfordtang was an earlier community that split and emerged. This is where Charleston emerged from. So there were five communities, and then one of the communities got into a conflict with the British that produced the Second Maroon War. And so that community was actually deported. Most of the members were deported and sent to Canada before being sent to Sierra Leone. So they were left with about four Maroon communities. And the four Maroon communities are still in existence in Jamaica. The one Maroon community in the Leeward Island, the Leeward Maroons, is the Akampang Maroons, still exists, while on the western end of the island, those three other communities exist, and they have their own unique formation structure, which I probably get into a bit later too.
Sure. Yeah. And you just talked a little bit, or you touched upon the idea of sort of privileging the actual narratives that the Maroons have of themselves, right? And so I wonder, what sort of new vantage points do we get by actually privileging the voices of the people that we're actually talking about, in this case, these sort of Maroon communities?
Yes. So in my work, I wanted to explore how Maroon themselves practice the idea of diaspora. So I wanted to know from them how they practice the idea of diaspora, but at the same time, they practice the idea of diaspora is very much linked to their history and how they see themselves. And so I felt that, from the oral tradition, it was helpful in a sense where when you hear the oral tradition from the Maroon, oftentimes the British narrative, as I mentioned, usually oftentimes was privileged, the enemy of the group of people you're trying to understand and learn about. And so you would have where I think oral tradition would give you an opportunity to actually get a better sense of how what really happened. I see myself as an interdisciplinary scholar, so I would look at the archive, but I also want to read against the grain of the archives. I want to look at oral tradition and see what the community value, what they remember and what they choose to forget and what they consider valuable and how they value things. So for me, what the Maroons have certain narrative where when I went to a different Maroon communities, especially Akampangtong, they would tell you that we defeated the British in the war, and they would give you different stories. They would tell you that we control our territory that we won was like almost 25% of Western Jamaica. Like it was a large particular area where you would see different things coming from the archives or from different scholars. But you would see in the Maroon narrative, most people would question like, oh, where's the evidence of this? But if you look closely at the archive itself, you would see from the Maroons signed a treaty in 1730s, you would see 10 years wouldn't pass without the Maroon communities. So you would see in maybe 1760, the Maroons claiming land that is far away from their current settlement. Then in 1780, you would see them claiming another set of land far away, supposedly, from their settlement. Then you see them every just about decade, sometime every year, sometimes, you know, multiple times in a year, they're claiming territories very far from where their home location, their home settlement is. And so you have a record of the Maroons claiming these territories for like going for almost 300 years. So, you know, in the Maroon, at least, you know, for the Maroons, they have a long tradition of claiming that they own territories that seem to be outside the territory. So it showed that they actually had a long collective consciousness of an agreement that perhaps the British deny or didn't accept. But you see it in the record. You know, when they tell you, you will be thinking like, okay, they're making it up for today. But if you look at the reports among the British, you would see that they claim in territory that supposedly, you know, belong to the British. But also to the two Maroon communities that existed was, in the West, was Akampangtong and Kojotang. And for the Maroons, they would tell you, those two communities were about 8 miles apart. So the question would be, why would the Maroons make an agreement to separate their communities? You know, for them, this whole, you know, like the communities were connected. And so the communities were wider. So you get to see what the Maroons are saying could be also reflected in some of the things that the British are challenging. For example, the British would also say, you know, the idea is that the Maroons defeat the British. So for most people, it's like, how a small group of people could defeat the British, which is conquering India, conquering all the parts of the world. But if you also look again at the narrative of the British, before they signed the treaty, the British would say, if we don't sign an agreement with the Maroons, we could lose the whole island, you know, because we could lose the whole island, basically. And so you would see the British saying that. Then when the treaty is signed, they would say something similar, but 20 years after the treaty would sign, they said they came to an agreement with the Maroons in order to, you know, like to gain peace. Then 50 years later, they would tell you, oh, the Maroons came on their knees begging for mercy, begging us to accept them. But you would see in British tradition, if they get hold of Maroon community and they're able to defeat Maroon communities, they usually execute them, burn them, put their bodies, take off their heads and put their heads in the middle of the community so other people would know not to rebel. And so it's usually something that is really done gruesome to the Maroon community. So hearing the Maroon's perspective, it give you a sense of like what you need to look for also in the archive itself and to see how to read against the grain and actually see what most likely was possible, because you could see what was happening, that perhaps the Maroon narrative make much more sense than what the British is saying, because they kept a record of what they're saying, but they forgot what they have said about something maybe 20 years before or 30 years before. And that information is also in the archive. So the Maroon community, I think, through our tradition, give you a sense of a way of really revealing the past, really understanding the past, that the written records may produce distortion of that reality. And if we only look at documentations of the past through written documents by people who are enemy of the people that we are trying to explore, it produces a distortion of that reality. And I think that oral history is a way of getting around those obstacles.
Absolutely, yeah. And so your second chapter is titled after one of the three key elements that you sort of spoke about earlier. It's titled Black Abjection. So if I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about what Black Abjection is and in what way this concept is important to the formation of sort of the African diaspora, and also how it relates specifically to the Jamaican Maroons communities that you write about in this book.
So Black Abjection is really the attempt to expel. Basically, abjection is to expel someone from that person, from humanity, from being full part of humanity. So for me, in many ways, Black Abjection is where you blacken people of African descent up, attempts of people of African descent being pushed out of humanity, where they deny full rights of humanity, basically. Which exists today in many ways too, where in somehow they are not full human, they are not full deserving of privilege and rights of humanity. So Black Abjection is the idea that Black people are not, you know, full humans. And in the work of diaspora, my argument, what other scholars have also highlighted, is the idea of the dehumanizing of Africans and the attempt to push Africans out of the realm of humanity. So in doing this, I feel that this is done to all people of African descent. And so it's not the only reason. I would argue, like some scholars might argue, that's what produced the diaspora. But I think that it helped influence why diaspora emerged. Because diaspora, for me, when you look at diaspora, look at African diaspora in particular, it's usually emerged because the people who exist cannot somehow exist within the society. For example, if you have a European, like Donald Trump, Donald Trump, his ancestors come from Germany and come from the UK. And I think his grandmother or grandfather came from there. He comes to the United States and he's easily assimilated into American society and he's accepted fully as an American. But someone who's of African descent may not be fully accepted as American, even though they have been here for 400 years. So within diaspora, there's this expel, you know, there's this way where the person is not accepted within the community that they're in. And so oftentimes they are forced to find some other location, someplace else. So people often turn to Africa in terms of where the place of origins, where do we belong, or where we can fit in. So because of Black Abjection, which I believe affect all people of African descent in the Western Hemisphere, and my argument to also in the work is that in the Western Hemisphere, every single one of the states in the Western Hemisphere were produced by white supremacists, whether it's the United States, Canada, whether it's Jamaica, whether it's Trinidad, whether it's even Brazil and these different places. So these societies were set up where Africans are not full human beings. A colonial system was set up where Africans are not full human beings. They are slaves and they are not full human beings. And the social system, the political system, the economic system reinforced that. And it creates a hierarchy depending where you are. If you're in the United States, because the Black population was relatively small, the idea is if you are mixed with Black, you become Black, so you become that outcast. But if you have someplace like Jamaica or someplace in the Caribbean where the white population is very small, when you mix with a white population, you start to become elevated from being Black, but you become sort of a middle area where you are sort of the buffer zone to protect the white elite structure, white racist structure, against the masses of people of African descent. And so we have this structure that is created for over 300 years, where it is reinforced, where we have everyone supposed to participate in this hierarchical structure that put the Africans to the bottom and put the European to the top. And each society in the Western Hemisphere does it in a different way. And you see also where it's not only structured in a way where it's in the colonial structure, but it's also in the social structure where perhaps people who are perhaps perform Europeanness or whiteness, they are elevated within the society. They are given rewards and support. And when you perform Africanness or blackness, you are oppressed, you are resisted, you know, you find resistance. And so this whole society is structured in a way where it reflects in terms of when you have hair that look more like European, you have good hair. When you have skin that is lighter, you have good skin. You know, so when you have dark skin, so it permeates throughout the whole society. And so this kind of structure that was created is still evident today, where even in the United States, if you're a person of African descent, when you want to get insurance, the insurance costs more because you are black, not because you are black because of your skin color. But the idea is that you are a person of African descent and you are higher risk because the society knows you are higher risk. You have a higher chance of dying, you know, at the hands of a police officer. You have a higher chance of dying of diseases. You have a higher chance of all of these things. And this has to do with the society that was created under true black objection, you know, through the idea that Africans are not full human beings and they don't deserve treatments of full human beings. So I argue that diaspora emerged as a means to challenge that kind of characterization and to change the system.
And so another one of these three sort of essential tenets that you had here was connective consciousness, right? So you state in the work that Maroons make distinctive claims of origin as a means of anchoring and linking themselves to Africa. So I wonder if you could just explain to us how that takes place and the importance of this to the Maroon communities, and then also how this connects to the idea of connective consciousness.
Okay, so yes. Thank you for the question. So the Maroons, part of my argument is that you could look at different communities of African descent and look, and you can see how they perform or how they engage or practice, or critically practice what I would say sometimes, the idea of diaspora. So for the Jamaican Maroons, they trace their origins to the continent of Africa generally, but they highlight certain communities, and a community they highlight the most is Akan, what is today Ghana. So the Maroons would, within the Maroons' culture and you perhaps expression in terms of tangible and intangible cultural forms, you would see that practice or that connection in the community when you visit the community itself. And one of the ways that they make these connections to the continent is through, for example, oral tradition. In the oral tradition, you would hear different narratives of the Maroon community, of their origins. And so when I went to different members of the community, they would have similar stories about their origins, even though particular member of the communities don't know each other, you know, they would have a similar narrative of their own history. So it's a collective consciousness of that history. But they also have what is referred to in terms of the intangible cultural expressions. You have what is called the Koromanti language. So in Maroon communities, the language is not as strong as it used to be. And now mainly only phrases are used, but it depends on which community you go to. Some community have that language is a bit stronger than it is in other communities. But many of the words, if you even go through the literature, many of the words are tied to the Twi language in Ghana, which is the most popular language in Ghana today. So some of the words like Abeng, Akwaba, you would hear in Maroon communities, and this is what they link. This is how they link themselves to their origins in Ghana with with that language and with those words, but also to in terms of their political system. In the Maroon communities, the political system is so that the leader of the community is called a colonel, but also too, they used to use it as use the word chief. So it's like for them, for the Maroon community, they have a council, a Maroon council that governs the whole community. And so this Maroon council and the Maroon leader, which is a colonel or chief, he is he's sort of the protector, he or she's sort of the protector of the land, or hold the land on behalf of the community. So the land is communally held. The land isn't owned by a particular individual, but it's owned by the whole community, but the custodian of the land is in the chief. And it's similarly done in African communities in Ghana. So the Maroons also trace their connection to Ghana and the Gold Coast in that way, in terms of how they set up their communities. And within the communities, they have the council, and the council make decision for the community and give direction to the communities in many ways too. And they also have spiritual practices, which you know, which the Maroon community also tied to coming from Ghana, coming from their ancestors. So they have times where the Maroons are practicing their religions, where their ancestors could actually visit one of the living members and be able to communicate with the living members through a particular member of the community to give the community guidance and direction. So this they also link to their African heritage, and also to in Jamaica, but this is also in many other islands. You have what is called Anansi stories. So for me, I grew up myself hearing Anansi stories because I grew up in the Caribbean. And in the Maroon community themselves, you know, I was told many Anansi stories there. And when I traveled to Ghana, when I was doing my research, and now I'm living in Ghana, I've heard Anansi stories too. And some of the stories are actually the same Anansi stories, you know, where these stories have been told in Ghana for many centuries, and the same thing in the Caribbean. These stories have been told in the Caribbean for many centuries, and some of the stories are very much similar. In Ghana, I found that the stories had much more detail. Like, they would give you very detail of the clothes Anansi was wearing. You know, they would give you much more detail, while in the Caribbean, it would be more like shorter and more of a lesson in overview. But in Ghana, it was much more detailed, but it's still a link to that African tradition. But also to the Maroon communities also argue that they have tangible heritage in the community. For example, the community that is called Akompang is actually named after the leader of the community. And the leader of the community, the Maroon communities would argue that he actually come from a name in Ghana, which is like Achompang, which is a popular name in Ghana. And so they believe that their leaders also had those names. Like, they also had a community of Cholanitang, which is also known as Kojotang. So that's also a popular name in Ghana, in terms of Kojo as a Monday born. And so they believe that these things are also tangible in terms of their community, in terms of naming. But they also have a place called, they also have the African burial ground in Akompang, where they say that the different ancestors, like the Koromanti, the Ashanti, and the Congo, are buried in these particular burial grounds in the community. The community also have 60 places they call seed grounds, and these are places where you could connect with the ancestors. So they believe also this comes from their African tradition, but they also have an instrument called a beng. And it's also called a horn instrument. They call it a beng in Maroon communities. And in Ghana itself, you call a horn instrument a beng. And when I went to Ghana to do my research in 2014, actually went to the, I had a colleague of mine, a friend of mine, who was a student at the University of Ghana, and he was from the Ashanti region, and he took me to a celebration among the Ashantis. And when I went to the event, they had, you know, in the Jamaican Maroon community, they have a beng, and it's a cow horn. and it's about maybe 12 inches long. But when I went to actually Ghana itself, when the Ashanti Henny came out, the leader of the Ashanti people, they blew a bangs, and they had some that was 12 inches long, but they had some that were like, 2 feet long. They had some that were 3 feet long. They had some that looked like they were, you know, very long and different sizes. And so you see the connection between the Maroons and different expression in Ghana. So that's like, you know, the main way that the Maroons tie themselves to this African origins, but they tie it in not only in oral tradition or in words, but they make that connection through tangible and intangible items or cultural expression in their community. So that gives them opportunity to really highlight that link. And they use that link to argue that we are the first independent community of people of African descent in the Western Hemisphere. We were independent before the United States gained independence, they would argue, as we gained our independence, and it was acknowledged from the 1730s. And we encourage other Africans, other people of African descent, and we encourage Africans to come and celebrate this African community that we have created in the Americas. And so they use it as a means to try to connect with other people of African descent. So it's something that emerged, especially after the independence of Jamaica, where, you know, people of African descent were trying to find different ways of connecting to the African past, and the Maroons saw themselves as a medium of that connection, a space to also come where we could discuss ways of connecting and ways of improving the conditions of people of African descent. So every year in the Jamaican Maroon community, they have a celebration. So each four of the community have a celebration every year. And so Akampongtang is the community that have the largest celebration. And in their community, like for 1 year, when in the 90s, it was dedicated to, Nelson Mandela. It was dedicated to Nelson Mandela and to fight against the issue of apartheid and how Black people could organize to fight against these issues. Then other times, you know, it's different issues. When it comes to issue of reparations, they also talk about reparations. So they see themselves as also a place and a platform to discuss and engage in ways that people of African descent could connect and improve their conditions.
And so you're, when you brought up sort of the chief or the colonel, I couldn't help but think about your idea of sovereignty, right? The importance of sovereignty to these Maroon societies, that they sort of view themselves as sovereign communities. And I'm just wondering, what does that mean in terms of how they view themselves in relation to sort of colonial powers and also to just sort of the larger African diaspora as well?
Okay. So let me describe the Akampong a little bit, perhaps describe their political structure a little bit and their argument for sovereignty. So the Maroons would argue, they have two arguments, I would say, depending on who you speak to and which community you go to and what time you go to the community. So the argument when I was there most recently was that we were free in Africa. We had our own community. We had our own society and we were sovereign in Africa. And when we were brought to Jamaica, we rebelled from the plantation and we recreated those communities, those sovereign communities in Jamaica. So we set up African kingdoms in Jamaica. And this is where our independence, sovereignty comes from, really. But when we signed the treaty in 1739, it was then the British acknowledge our sovereignty. Sometimes people argue that Maroons say they gained their sovereignty through the treaty, but many of the Maroons, some would say that, but some of the Maroons, especially the elders, would say that, no, the treaty just acknowledged our sovereignty. And then you have some Maroons who would say, well, we joined, when we rebelled from the plantation, even though they were small numbers, we joined the indigenous people, the Tainos. They were always sovereign. They have always been here. So the issue of sovereignty for some of them is that we are always being sovereign. So asking how we become sovereign isn't a question. The question is asking how we lost our sovereignty then is the question, because it always has been there. So that's some of the argument in terms of sovereignty. And also how the government is structured. As I mentioned to you, there's a Maroon Council. There's also for the book project that I did ended in 2021. So the past colonel, so there was a new colonel, a new chief that came into power office in 2021. So when I did the interview, it was with the previous colonel, Williams, Foreign Williams, and he had his council, or his government had a senior council, which includes senior members of the community, and the members was about maybe 15 to 20 different members. And then he had a junior council that had about 10 members, and this represents the youths. And then they had the full Maroon Council, which is sort of like a senate in the community, but they are all within the overall governance structure of the community. And they also have, in Akampong in particular, from since the 1950s, they have elections every 5 years. So every 5 years, different members of the community allow the community members to vote who should become the next leader of the community. So they have been doing that from 1950s with the government, and also to they have communally held land. The land belongs to all of the Maroons, not just, the land belongs to all the Maroons, not just, it is not owned by individual. The land is collectively owned, and it's something that the Maroons have fought for, for 300 years. They have continually have to fight for the communal land. They do not pay taxes to the Jamaican state because they believe that land belongs to the whole community, but they also believe that the land belongs to the ancestors. The land belongs to those who are living, and the land also belongs to those who are unborn. So if you want to do anything to the land, and this is where the issue of mining becomes an issue in Jamaica, and it also become an issue where Maroon community actually challenge the capitalist orientation of Jamaica and the Western Hemisphere in many ways, because the idea of having communal land, and also to that if we are going to mine or do anything on the land, we have to consult the ancestors first. We have to consult those who are living, and then we have to think about how we will affect our children who are unborn. And so for them, for the community, that's how they believe in making decisions and how to maintain the community. So the community is also made up of many members that do not live on the current settlement that they're living on. Many of the Maroons, some of them live as far away as New York City, London, Canada. But they believe if you could trace your ancestry to someone with Maroon blood, you're also a Maroon. So the idea of the Maroon community is also very much open. So when the Maroons have election in Akampong, people from even Kingston who are living in Kingston and living in different parts of Jamaica could participate in the election. And they're even trying to find ways of having the Maroons who are outside of Jamaica to also participate in the election. So they have particular views of the land. And in Jamaica right now, they have issues of mining of bauxite, which the Maroons and the Jamaican state and foreign companies' interests in the bauxite, including the United States and the interests of the Chinese, have brought the issue back to the forefront, because they are interested in doing mining in the areas that the Maroon claim territory in. So there's also some other symbols of Maroon sovereignty, in terms of they first started working on a constitution in the 1940s. I wasn't able to get a copy of it, but they started working on a constitution in the 1940s, and they worked on another one in the 1990s. And there was one done about 10 years ago, and recently in 2000, this year, there was a new constitution submitted in Maroon community. They also have their own flag. Recently, they even had a bank, but the bank is not operating on their own. They have their own bank. They're talking about issues of ID and different things like that. So they have created some level of of symbols of statehood, of nationhood within the community in terms of arguing for their sovereignty. And in many ways, though, how Maroons look at sovereignty, and it becomes an issue, like, what is sovereignty and what does it mean? So when you go to, especially Akompong, you wouldn't only hear the leaders talk about their sovereign. You would hear a four-year-old child talking about Maroon community sovereign. You know, so, like, it's everywhere in the community, and this is how the Maroon community see themselves. But how they define sovereignty is not always the same way where other places maybe define sovereignty, but they see sovereignty as they having the right to decide the direction that they want to take their community, basically. You know, and so oftentimes people raise the question of, you know, control, economy, and you know, raise certain things. But for the Maroons, they don't see a system from the Jamaican state as something that means they don't have sovereignty, because they believe that you could be interdependent and still be sovereign at the same time. Because they would also argue that the globe is in many ways interdependent, how we interact with each other. But, you know, there should be some space for us to decide what is in the best interest for us as a collective group, and what is in the best interest of our community, and how we define community should be considered. And so the relationship with the Jamaican state is that the British state is actually very much complicated, where in terms of in the history, you see sometimes where the Maroons are very much independent, depending on the given time period, and they have other times where they face a lot of pressure from the colonial state, where they're able to put certain pressure on the Maroon communities to act a certain way, but they have other times where the Maroon communities are able to leverage their unique origins and their community to push the Jamaican state into the British state into another direction. So they also believe that they have a connection, a deep connection with African diaspora. As I mentioned, when they see collective consciousness with other people of African descent, they see themselves as one of the first freedom fighters, and they encourage other people to support them in the freedom struggle. Where they try to support other Africans in the freedom struggle. Not that they never had, I mean, and in defining diaspora, you know, we must also look at not that they never had tension between Maroon groups and other groups of Jamaica, and not that they don't have tension between people of African descent. There is tension, but the idea is that we are somehow connected and we should work together in improving our conditions. And so Maroons more than ever, I think, especially in the last 20 years, they are reaching out to connect to other people of African descent more to help other people of African descent, but also to enhance their community.
And so what do you want readers to take away from your book?
The main thing I would want readers to take away from my book is that that there are many different ways of defining the African diaspora. You know, diaspora, but also the African diaspora in particular. In my work, I was trying to define, my attempt to define diaspora, my goal was, original attempt was to define diaspora in general and how it worked everywhere. And it's sometimes very difficult to get, because, I mean, they have so many diasporas. I mean, they even have digital diaspora. You could go to the Roman diaspora, you could go to the diaspora of communities that don't exist anymore. You have the Punjabi diaspora. There are many different diasporas. So I wanted to actually focus on, let's look at a particular diaspora, the African diaspora, not even the Ghanaian diaspora, which is connected to the African diaspora, not the Akan diaspora, which is connected to the African diaspora, not the Jamaican diaspora, but what is this idea of African diaspora I wanted to explore and look at. And if a group of people identify with diaspora, how does it work? So my work wanted to highlight that these three elements is something that, from my study, these three elements I mentioned, all diaspora that are all group that consider themselves part of the diaspora identify with those elements. They have the element which is route. Like some people talk about, when you talk about Paul Gilroy, is not so much roots, but routes. But I would argue that the routes are connected to other routes that are connected to the route. And so even though when you mention African diaspora, you have to somehow talk about Africa in some way, even if you disavow the origins of Africa, of people of African descent in Africa, you have to at least engage it in some way. So even though you might not say, oh, I'm not African, but I'm a part of the African diaspora, you have to address it, you know, in some ways. But I think also too that African diaspora is also too, I want people to get away with it. It's some way it could be viewed as a critical practice. And so if you look at how different groups of people of African descent engage those key concepts, you could tell in many ways how, their goal of what it is to be, what is this for the African diaspora to be liberated. For Maroon community, I'm arguing that they see the main way of liberating African is to create sovereignty, to create sovereign communities, while in other places, you know, different communities might have, like Rastafari would have a different idea of like what it is to create sovereign community. They would highlight the significance of Ethiopia, but they would highlight having connection to God is the main way for African people to liberate themselves. So different communities have different ways of liberating themselves from Africa. But my argument was that to use diaspora as a tool that could explain the means that different groups of people of African descent are using to improve Black standing in the world generally. And I think that we do need different ways of liberating people of African descent, because some of the conditions are not the same. Sometimes it varies from place to place. And so sometimes it calls for different strategies to improve the condition of people of African descent. But it's, in the end, a way of bringing the full humanity of African people. As I feel, I argue that diaspora, the goal of diaspora is actually for people of African descent to have full humanity. In that way, in many ways, diaspora, if diaspora is really lived, there might not be a need for diaspora, because we are fully accepted as full human beings in this world, and we are accepted, you know, and so we don't necessarily need a means or method to liberate ourselves, because we would be all in that liberated space. Really.
Well, Dr. Nesbitt, we've taken up a lot of your time, and thank you again. But I'll ask you one final question here. What are you working on now?
Okay, so what I'm working on now currently, it's I'm part of it is my research project in Ghana. So I'm still working it out, and I've started the project, but it's taken a lot of turns. So my next goal was actually, and I started a project some time ago, was to look at how Africa itself engaged the diaspora. For me, the Maroon communities was looking at a particular personal group of African descent, how they engage Africa in terms of looking at diaspora, but I wanted to look at how Africa itself engaged diaspora and why. And so I wanted to focus particularly on Ghana, and also look Ghana as the cultural capital of Pan-Africanism. And I also wanted to look at Ethiopia a bit, like Ethiopia as the political capital, with the African Union being in Ethiopia, of how do they engage diaspora? How do they define diaspora? And how do they engage diaspora? And what are the means of, and oftentimes the idea of engaged diaspora is an issue of development. So I wanted to explore that idea. But I'm also interested in how to maybe look at, you know, global Africa, or look at how Africans and people of African descent work to improve the world in general. You know, how they mutually work to support each other, to create a new world, to create better conditions of people of African descent. So I'm still exploring that topic, and I'm trying to work it out. And so that's where I'm at in terms of my next research project. I have a few other projects in mind, but that's the main one on my agenda right now.
Yeah, that one sounds absolutely fascinating. So I guess we all have to look out for that when you sort of start publishing around that. I personally would be very interested in looking into that. So Dr. Mario Nesbitt, the author of The Workings of Diaspora, Jamaican Maroons and the Claims to Sovereignty, I want to thank you again for being on the show. I really enjoyed it, and take care.
Okay, thank you.